You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 185 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you once again from the home of the Pelton Cast, Boulevard Park, Washington.
Hello!
Hello!
It feels good to be back again! In Boulevard Park, you managed to pronounce the city that you live in correctly this week.
We're already off to a better start. I'm not flustered.
Pre-flustered.
Yeah, we may get there eventually. If it's a good podcast, we'll get there.
It is Thanksgiving week. It's one of our favorite weeks of podcasting every year. Because every year, we can re-release the podcast that we did with Nate Duncan.
It was an all-timer. It was a classic. And if you haven't listened to it, our countdowns of the top five Thanksgiving foods, that will be at the end of this very podcast once you sit through all the sports content.
No fast-forwarding. No clicking.
I'm not going to put that in the post notes. Not going to allow you to figure it out. That's a lie. Of course I'm going
to
do it.
So go ahead and listen to that at the end of this if you haven't already. If you have, it's a great re-listen.
It ages well.
Just
I assume. I haven't listened to it yet.
I'll tell you, in the couple of years since we recorded that, gravy has just had such a rise.
Has it?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I don't know. People was it gravy are really already starting really to rethink the sweet potato pie. Things have changed a lot.
Some of the condiments, some of the sides look problematic in hindsight.
Yeah.
All right, well, that'll be at the end. But let's start at the beginning.
Roles have been canceled.
Oh, no.
It's cancel culture.
kind of saw it coming, if we're being honest. Let's start at the beginning with our beer, which is Elysian's The Noise. Limited edition pale ale brewed in partnership with the Seahawks as the craft beer partner of them. Elysian Brewery brings The Noise. This highly drinkable pale ale swaggers with hints of citrus, candied orange, and vanilla. The Noise is as much a home field advantage as 69,000 unified voices, which helped the Seahawks be much worse at home than on the road. Sorry,
hey, Joe DeFoyo's coming back. Just wait.
I don't know if he actually is. Has he responded to this yet?
To the DeFoyo signal that was put out by Pete Carroll this morning? Yeah. I think he's available.
It's loud and proud. A portion of the net proceeds from every can sold goes to help eliminate homelessness through Plymouth Housing. So that's good news as well. All right. Let's crack these open. Because we can toast to a Seattle Seahawks victory against the Philadelphia Eagles to move to 9-2 on the season. Oh, my God. We're 9-2.
I really don't even know how we got here.
By winning 9 games and losing 2. That is refreshing. You know what that tastes like?
What's that?
Tastes like a forward lateral by a defender.
I thought that he fumbled it. It was intentional.
Oh, that was 100% intentional.
Watching live, like,
that's why Pete Carroll was talking about lateral aid and how they used to practice.
I mean, I saw in the replay, but watching live, it didn't look to me like he. It looked like he had fumbled it again, and then Shaquem picked it up. I mean, obviously in the replay, like, I was surprised at the flag.
I was not surprised at the flag.
I was busy jumping up and down about a big man running.
It was very exciting. So I was watching this game in Denver at Blake Street Tavern with the Seahawkers fan club, Rocky Mountain Group.
There we go.
Which involved a surprising amount of cowbell. Not something I traditionally associate with the Seahawks.
Okay.
But we did have the sound in there, but it was loud in there and the sound was on kind of low. So I was kind of like trying to rely on vaguely looking at the TV and Twitter to figure out whether they were actually to call him down on that play before the fumble.
I assume when that play happened, it erupted with the noise.
It 100% did.
In the bar. Were there fans of other teams? Were there Bronco fans around?
Well, it was a separate room, but there were Eagles fans in there.
Oh, no.
There were also Raiders fans with my group, and they were having a real tough time. Not great. I mean, God,
they
the
put the
game.
Eagles fans in the same room as the Seattle. What kind of fishbowl is happening at
I didn't necessarily
expect Blake
that,
Street Tavern?
I guess they wanted the sound as well, obviously. For my friends who did the UW Colorado game Saturday night, Raiders Sunday morning back to back, that was a rough one in terms of football. Not great.
Wow.
All right, but we have other toasts to get to besides to the Seahawks being 9-2. All right, next up, it's both a toast and pouring some out for Tyee High School and UW alum Steve Poole, who announced last week that he's in remission for prostate cancer, which is great to hear, but also announced his retirement after more than 4 decades at Como. So, Steve Poole has been a fixture on Como's broadcast throughout our lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. And we've never once watched Como News.
No, but never once.
It's always been a distant third if you're ranking the news sources.
Wow, that's going to be the Peltoncast search for Seattle's best newscast.
Right?
I mean, it's got to be like circa 1995, because that's when I watched the newscast more regularly than I do.
I feel like growing up, we were like a King 5 family. Right?
Yeah, I would agree that was probably number one.
It's the only... I mean, I don't watch television news.
Our grandparents, I feel like, were more devoted to Cairo.
They're a Cairo family because they're old.
Yeah.
They're dead now. But because they were old. Most Cairo fans are.
RIP our grandparents.
Then Como is a pretty distant number three. Right? I don't even know... I don't know Como people.
You don't know Dan Lewis? Kathy Gertson?
I know the people...
Oh, the people... I see. People who are Como viewers. I mean, there must be many of them out there. Como also the only one out there that did a segment featuring me.
There you go.
Yeah.
And then Fox is like, that's a really distant number four.
I mean, they didn't even have a local newscast in the 90s. So
King and Cairo are right up there, right next to each other.
Too late to the game.
Huge, huge space to Como. Bigger space to Fox.
But shouts to Steve Poole.
Steve Poole. I mean, he's one of the most famous Tyee alums. So.
Yeah, right up there with the Green River Killer.
I wasn't going to mention it.
I was going there.
You went there.
Oh, I didn't go to Tyee.
More famous. You did go to Tyee, for sort the record.
I'll claim Tyee when it's convenient, but not when the Green River
When we're talking about Steve Poole, you went to Tyee. And yes. When we're talking about the Green River Killer, you went to Mount Rainier.
Exactly.
Great.
Adam Smith, I'll claim Tyee. Michael Sawyer, 100%. Stacey Ross, yes. Next up, to UW men's soccer. For reaching the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament with a 2-0 win over Boston College on Sunday. They'll host number 11 seed Marshall in the next round, looking to advance to the Elite Eight.
Okay, so tell us about Marshall.
I have not done a full scouting report on Marshall. Their nickname is the Thundering Herd.
Oh, okay.
They're the 11 seed.
Wow. Intel.
They won a game last round.
There we go.
Maybe if they get to the Final Four, we'll get full like preview coverage. Or the
if Marshall gets to the Final Four,
no, if UW gets there,
okay.
Not Marshall gets there. Also on that front, to UW Benson women's soccer coaches Jamie Clark and Leslie Gallimore, who are both named the Pac-12 Coach of the Year.
Wow,
in their respective sports. UW or Seattle, I should say, continuing to be a soccer town.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's it as far as toasts. So let's move ahead with our NBA Seattle update.
Do we have before then, do we have Denver food to talk about or really nothing of note?
The main thing that occurred on this trip was that I went to a number of food halls, which are apparently quite popular in Denver. And
because it's cold, so they put all their food into one big hall. It's like a food truck, but for cold places.
I mean, LA has the Grand Central Market downtown. It's the opposite of cold there. So I think it's just that Seattle is behind on this one. Portland has a couple of food halls, at least one.
Okay, as somebody who's never been to a quote-unquote food hall, I've been to mess halls, I've been to food courts.
Have you been to a mess hall?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
Never.
Yeah, you've been to food courts, so it's like an upscale food court. I mean, the Armory...
It literally is a food court, but people wanted to rebrand it because food courts have negative connotations.
I mean, because they have generic chain restaurants, uh-huh. Because they have Sbarro.
Uh-huh.
And food halls have higher quality food. So
why don't we just rebrand the food court? Not rebrand it. Why don't we just elevate the food court?
I mean, that basically is the food hall, yes.
Okay. So you went to a food court in Denver.
I went to a food court in Boulder before the game on Saturday. After going to the Oscar Blues tap room there in Boulder. That was
and yeah, fun. That's good beer.
Yeah.
Huh.
A lot of high quality craft beer in the greater Denver area, but had char siu pork on Saturday night at the food hall in Boulder, and then on Sunday went with a Cuban sandwich that was pictured on Instagram
at the food hall.
at Denver Central Market, yeah.
I mean, because basically, like, the Block 16 in Vegas, right, at Cosmopolitan, it's a food hall for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so food courts are coming back with better food is what you're telling me.
Yes.
This I can get behind.
Well, it's wonderful because the person I met for dinner in Denver, she went to one place, I went to another. That's, you know, you've got all sorts of different options if you don't want to have the exact same thing as the rest of your group.
Do you want to describe any more virtues of the food court? No, you can eat in a central place, like right in the middle. All the restaurants are on the outside. I mean, the other key difference
is that food carts don't usually have bars traditionally.
So there's a bar there also.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was at the Armory at Seattle Center.
Which is the closest we're going to get.
Hell of a food hall. They've got the little Christmas train set up in the middle.
Oh.
It wasn't going yet, though, because they don't believe in the Christmas creep.
But they've had it up.
They were getting it set up so it'd be ready. Okay.
No, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. All right. Now should we talk about the NBA Seattle update sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza?
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle. So do we.
You know who didn't want basketball in Seattle, as it turns out? It's the NBA.
Oh.
So last week was the finale of the Ringers podcast on Luminary Sonic Boom, hosted by Jordan Ritter-Kahn. And spoiler alert, the team moved to Oklahoma City.
Oh, God.
I think the most interesting part of the final episode was the conversation with the Seattle City Attorney, Tom Carr, who was handling their lawsuit against the professional basketball club, the Oklahoma City Ownership Group, trying to force them to stay in Seattle for the final 2 years of their lease at Key Arena, and explaining why they eventually settled, despite the fact that he hated the deal as a basketball fan. And he brought up the NBA's pressure that, look, if you continue with this lawsuit, you're never going to see basketball back again. Which, imagine that.
Oh, man.
How horrible would that have been?
Wow.
But it also didn't really come up because it was only touched on tangentially. But the NBA also supposedly pressured the group fronted by Howard Schultz that was bringing a lawsuit to enforce the specific performance clause of in the sale of the team. That one got settled much later, like the Friday before Labor Day weekend, but that also got dropped, and supposedly for the same reason.
Well, the team was already in Oklahoma. They weren't moving back at that point.
It was going to be pretty tough at that point, yes. So not great NBA.
I have nothing else to say about this. I feel like I've said everything I have to say about this podcast, but I know that you're going to reject the premise of this question.
It's my favorite thing to do.
And you said, I asked you who the villains were last time. Somehow you... Jedi mind tricked yourself into saying the Seahawks and the Mariners and
stay by
organized sports, mess halls, food courts. These were all
maybe
the
if there had been food court.
Howard Schultz's name somehow didn't come up, but
I think everyone takes that for granted. If there had been a food court in the Armory back then, maybe things would have been different.
After listening to the last episode of the podcast, where does David Stern and the NBA, did they shoot up the rankings?
They did, because I had forgotten. It's not that I had forgotten it, but I had forgotten how big a factor that really was. And I do want to say while we're on this topic, I don't think it would have mattered if the city of Seattle had won its lawsuit against the
we were going to argue about this.
Yes, we were.
Oh.
So let's do that now.
Oh, okay.
The bridge of the Sonics staying in Seattle was not just burned. It was, you know, barricaded so that it was prevented from being rebuilt. Like, it was too far gone at that point. It was personal for David Stern, which is part of the reason that these threats were allegedly being made. I don't think that even if for some reason the Oklahoma City ownership group had been unable to move the team to OKC because the financial crisis hit that fall, that would have meant they would have sold to a local ownership group at that point. They would have just sold to someone else who would have moved it. You know, probably Larry Ellison would have moved it to San Jose, which is...
And he would have just waited out 2 years.
Yeah. And it would have been just the worst 2 years you can imagine. Like, it was already pretty bad at the end of 2007-08.
You still have hope if there's a team here, right?
I get that. But again, like... When David Stern is running around talking about the team will leave, it's just a matter of when. Like, that's not leaving the door open. That's not cracking the door open. That's slamming it shut. Well, quite a counter argument you raised here.
I don't know. I have no energy for this anymore. I feel like we've talked about the Sonics so much. It's just like the team's fucking gone. Who cares? It's like really, I felt like the takeaway from the podcast was that like there's nothing that the masses can do. We argued about this also on the side, which I sort of agree with and I also sort of disagree with. Because I do feel like the demand and the interest of local fans is a hugely important thing for getting these teams there. I also at the same time think that David Stern being hell-bent on moving this team and making it an example of the city of Seattle and probably feeling like personally offended by the city of Seattle or whatever, Washington State, was more important. But I do think that the interest of fans in Seattle still mattered.
Like if there had been more interest that they could have kept the team? Are you saying that the Sonics fans are a villain here?
I don't know. I'm just saying.
I don't understand your argument.
I'm saying that interest in things as a fan is still important. The reason there's a hockey team in Seattle is because people will go to it.
The reason there's a hockey team, I mean, they will, but it's because of the perception that they will go to it.
And they will. Like, they bought the tickets.
Like there's a
people. But people are buying tickets for 5 years out.
There's an aspect of if you build it, they will come. And that's what happened in Oklahoma City to an extent, too. It's not like Oklahoma City in 2005 was sitting there thinking, you know what we need? The NBA.
There are places that that's not the case, though.
I suppose. I mean, there's better markets than others. I don't dispute that. But I one thing I think we have learned is that Sonics fans are not a very powerful political bloc in terms of voting. We learned that again in the most recent city council election.
I mean, honestly, that's... I suppose if you really want to have a takeaway from it, it's that people felt like there was this large coalition and there really wasn't that large of a coalition. And that coalition didn't exist in the city of Seattle.
Or, yeah, didn't necessarily have the ability to vote in the city of Seattle.
The people who I really blame, not the least, there's a lot of, there's associated blame all along the way.
How much do you blame me for the Sonics moving?
A lot. It really is the people who were... I don't know exactly what I'm saying here. Wait. I don't blame the politicians in Washington State nearly as much as you do. Because if this was on the ballot, it was not going to win.
But that's not the reason that they didn't approve it. Like, then if you think that, then just let it go to the ballot. It's not that expensive to have
an initiative. It would have lost there.
Fine. But
single initiative that was anti-arena was going to win and was winning at the time. And any initiative that was on the ballot, they didn't even vote to have either of the other stadiums.
They voted for the Seahawks stadium.
Okay, and they voted for the football stadium with the billionaire's money behind it in the ad campaign.
Sure. I mean, sure. I think that when people say that they went against the will of the people to build Safeco Field, that is in what is now T-Mobile Park, I think that is an utterly ridiculous argument. The vote failed by like a couple hundred votes.
Uh-huh. And the will of the people was to go to the Christmas thing.
Immediately.
What's that called?
The thing. The winter.
Like the people love that.
Immediately after that, the Mariners went on a miracle run and rallied tremendous fan support. If you would have held the vote again on October 31st, it would have passed comfortably.
Okay, then let me ask you this question. If you're going to use that line of argument, let's say that the Sonics continue to draft Russell Westbrook, draft James Harden the next year. All of a sudden, you have the best young core in the NBA who's making a miracle run to a number 8 seed. Like, the entire city would have been behind that team, and you're telling me they still would have left.
Yeah, because at that point, it didn't matter. The owner has to be on board. You can't just build a stadium and force the arena and force the owner to stay. Like,
What if the owner goes broke because of... But also, you're not... factoring in that the NBA would have liked to have somebody like Steve Ballmer as an owner, obviously did like to have him as an owner after that, and there's a chance that he could have become interested in the team. And if you are the NBA, even if you're hell-bent on moving this team, you're saying to yourself, we want Steve Ballmer as an owner. There is a team in his very city.
Too far gone.
They would have been more likely. I know that they hate expansion all of a sudden the second that the Sonics could have been expanded to, even though Charlotte got an expansion team 3 years later.
Yes.
Maybe. Oklahoma City would have been more likely to have gotten an expansion team than Seattle.
Yeah, it would make more sense to just keep the team here in that scenario. But I just don't think it was going to happen at that point. It was too far gone.
Okay.
I mean, the one thing I was thinking about in terms of like the whole, obviously it looks terrible in hindsight, like, oh, if we play nice now, the NBA will get us a team back. But like the Sacramento thing very nearly could have happened. And it's interesting to think about
person wouldn't have stepped in. Let's say that Adam Silver becomes the commissioner, whatever, 2 years earlier or something. Like, that was David Stern's final kiss off to the city of Seattle. That was the one last FU to the city of Seattle.
I don't think that was personal. I think that was just...
They have David Stern Lane.
Way
outside of the stadium. You don't think that there was a little bit about it that it was personal?
No, I don't think it had anything to do with it about Seattle. I think it was that Sacramento had been a very good market for the NBA. And the message had already been sent.
They love having teams in as small of markets as possible.
I think they also probably did learn a lesson. They realized how scorched the earth was in Seattle and didn't want to go through that again if
because they would put another team back in Sacramento. I mean, the reality was if that team moved from Sacramento, no team was ever going back in Sacramento.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying they wanted to, like, as long as local government was willing to step up with funding, they were not going to move a team. So the warning had already been sent and it was received. Although one argument, I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast.
How they should warn themselves about having teams, moving teams from the 12th best TV market to the 57th best TV market.
Is it 57th?
Somewhere around there.
It's low.
Most of the viewing populace is tumbleweeds.
That is not a fair assessment of Oklahoma City. We do not need to, impugn Oklahoma City here to make our points. Wait, I think I lost my train of thought here.
I said tumbleweeds, and then you got angry.
Yeah, you really knocked me off.
The idea that, and granted, everybody. I don't think
that the NBA needs the city of Seattle as leverage for other cities. Like that's actually part of their thinking.
Yes,
their reason they're not expanding is because they don't want to split up the TV money. That's it. If it's not Seattle, it'll always be some other market. The Kings were all set to move to Anaheim, I think 2 years before they were, they had been sold to the Hansen Group and were set to move to Seattle. There's always good, San Jose is still out there.
There's 100 markets that want NBA teams. Doesn't matter.
The NBA does not need Seattle for leverage.
Look, they've got the 58th best TV market, the 59th, the 60th.
I mean, mistakes were made. So the Sonics podcast, Sonic Boom, check that out if you haven't. It's been a while. It's time for the return of your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
So I don't know if you saw the news. The Mariners signed first baseman Evan White to a 6-year contract with 3 team options worth between $24 million and the mid-$50 million range, as reported by ESPN's Jeff Passan. And if you're anything like me, when you first read this news, you were like, wait, who does Evan White play for? And how did the Mariners sign him as a free agent? Well, it turns out Evan White was the Mariners' first-round pick in 2017. And the reason you might not know his name is because he's never played higher than AA Arkansas, where he played last season. He became the very first player in the history of Major League Baseball to get a long-term contract like this without ever having played higher than AA. And here's my take on this. The Mariners haven't gone far enough. They need to start signing even younger players to contracts. I want baby fantasy genius to get a 20-year contract for the Mariners that locks him up well through his arbitration years and well into free agency. Let's keep going, Mariners. You can't ever take it far enough.
Wow. Mariners hot takes really returned. And I will say, they returned just in time.
Did they?
They returned in time for us, the fabulous Pelton brothers, to guest on Lookout Landing series, Why You're a Mariners Fan, or in our instance, Why You're Maybe Not a Mariners Fan.
Well, Why You're Still a Mariners Fan.
That's the series, is Why You're, or is it for us?
No, that is. Yeah, that's it. Why You're Still a Mariners Fan.
Oh, well, maybe Why You're Still Not a Mariners Fan.
In our case, yes. Yes.
Which is going up on Wednesday, I will say.
We literally just recorded it in between the time we did the last segment and this one. And it's a classic.
You're... I think I said after that we just blessed them with a classic episode. You said, I did not expect you to be standing that much. This was like Seahawks beating the Texans level of standing.
But for a very different kind of energy than when the Seahawks beat the Texans. A very different kind of energy.
So if you're not getting enough Ichiro slander on a day-to-day basis...
I think most of us are or aren't looking for, I guess.
Do you actually care about Ichiro?
Yes. Ichiro was like an amazing personality. And like this tortured soul.
In what
soul.
Regard? He never said anything.
Exactly.
I mean, I will say that the idea of Ichiro sort of like renting out baseball fields in Japan and like getting people from neighborhoods or whatever to play baseball with him, like I can sort of respect that. But at the same time, he never wore his hat backwards.
Anyway, just a preview of what you can expect on that Lookout Landing podcast.
Where we also each deliver Mariners hot takes at the very end.
That is true. Impromptu hot takes. You basically did radio Tristan in that one. Because it was like spur of the moment. You weren't prepared. There was a lot of yelling. It was great. But we got plenty more to talk about, so we can't talk about the Mariners anymore on this episode.
We already talked about the Mariners for a long time.
We did. A very long time. Sounders news. So last Wednesday was the deadline for contract options for the 2020 season, or I guess it was Thursday, but they announced them on Wednesday. And the Sounders notably did not declined the team option on Roman Torres, defender and midfielder Victor Rodriguez, the MVP of the MLS Cup. We talked last week about how Rodriguez wants to go back home to play in his native Spain, be closer to his family. And then Torres posted on social media over the weekend that his time with the Sounders has come to an end after that decision. Team's still apparently attempting to re-sign their other starting central defender, Kim Keehy, who's out of contract as well. They did exercise options on midfielders Handwala Buana, Jordy Delem, and Gustav Svensson. Svensson may be a little bit of a surprise that he wanted to return to the Sounders in 2020.
Svensson.
Yeah, there'd been some talk that he might go back to Europe, much the same way as Torres could go back to play in South America at this point.
Why did they let Roman Torres go?
His salary is too high.
Okay.
And he might not have wanted to play in MLS anymore.
Okay.
So they've got a lot of money to play with. I think Rodriguez was making somewhere around $1 million, Torres $750,000. And then also, Sounder at Heart reported last week that the team and defensive midfielder Emmanuel Cecchini are, quote, exploring all options about ending his loan from Malaga ahead of the scheduled date. He was one of their marquee additions last offseason, but really never broke into the team as Brian Schmetzer settled on a regular 11, and Jordy Delem was playing against him ahead of him as a backup at defensive midfield. So not a huge surprise there, but that would also free up some more money for the Sounders to try to address the back line with the goal, I think, of getting younger. I mean, that's the other factor here is Torres is 33. So, you know, Kim is 30. So they brought in Javier Arriaga, who surely will be in the mix heavily next season at central defender, but, you know, maybe more in store there. Forward Justin Dillon also had his contract option picked up. So we'll see as the MLS offseason progresses. Some surprising news Monday about Reign FC, which announced exclusive negotiations to sell the team to the parent company of French soccer power Olympique Lyonnais. OL, as they're better known, is the dominant leader in European women's soccer, having won the last four Champions League titles and six overall in the past decade.
And typically known as Lyon, right?
Lyon is, yeah. the other short form. Local Reign FC owners Teresa and Bill Predmore, who brought the team into the NWSL, will retain a minority stake in the team if the sale is completed, with Bill Predmore continuing as CEO, and the team will remain in Tacoma. So operationally...
They're not moving to Lyon. After that Sonic talk, you know, you always worry about local ownership.
That's fair. Predmore talked about this. And a historian said that it came out of a conversation last year during the Women's World Cup, where originally Lyon had expressed interest in an NWSL expansion team, but then where they were kind of so impressed with what Reign FC had set up here that they wanted to be involved with them. So I think that's...
Is this the first foreign owner in the NWSL?
I think so. Certainly like another soccer club, like which we have seen in MLS, NYCFC, part owned by Manchester City. So it's not like a completely foreign concept. There was, you know, Chivas USA shared some ownership with Chivas.
I just gave a little zing there when you said foreign concept.
Oh, I didn't. It was not intentional. Pun was not intended. It'll be interesting to see if this means the teams share players at all. That's one question I have here.
Yeah, if the Reign FC could sort of act as a like youth system for Lyon.
I think that there will probably be an element of that because they've started an academy in the Seattle area.
I mean, I would assume just seeing the sort of pedigree of the Lyon team, that would mean they get some pretty incredible players here, right? Like they have to be getting some of the best young women's soccer players in all of Europe.
One would think. I don't know exactly how the development system works over there, whether, you know, it's as much you're developing talent as opposed to just acquiring it when those players establish themselves.
I'm pretty fascinated here.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how it's going to play out.
Well, and also that kind of influx of money definitely is probably a good sign for the NWSL.
Yeah, NWSL seems to be doing well financially. They're in a good place right now. It does feel like it probably would have been better for the league as a whole if they bought an expansion team, but... You know, maybe that would have been tough to find the right market for that or, you know, to build from the start. Yeah, certainly, you know, you wouldn't probably have that involvement by 2020. So, but feels like they're in a good place coming off the World Cup last year, heading into the Olympics next year to continue capitalizing on that interest in women's soccer, that overdue interest.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. UW men's basketball with a pair of wins at home last weekend, 73-56 on Friday over Montana, 88-69 on Sunday over San Diego. You were at the Montana game.
Oh, was I ever.
Tell us about that experience.
I don't think I went to a Husky basketball game last year.
I don't believe so.
I went in with all of my family. So we're talking 8 to 15 children.
Yeah. It's interesting. So Baby Fantasy Genius, the oldest, has been aggressively trying to go to
a UW. He's wanted to go to every single home game there was.
And then you posted a photo on Instagram of him looking so sad to be there.
No, he was having fun. He had a good time at the
game.
Okay,
it was just an out-of-context photo. He wasn't like, why are we watching college basketball?
He was looking sad in the photos when I was taking them, but he was having a good time being at the game.
Good. I'm glad he did. He likes fouls?
Oh, God. It was like it was a little heated. Literally, it was about 1,000 degrees inside of there, up in the rafters. But I was expecting to go in. I mean, we've been to so many Husky games where there's just nobody in the top three rows.
Yes.
Every inch of the arena was packed. He was like, I don't know what the hell happened. Maybe it was because it was Friday night.
I mean, they did announce last week before the Tuesday game, Mike Hopkins said that they had sold out his season tickets, and that seemed confusing because there were a lot of empty seats at the main game.
Well, maybe I should have gone to the main game.
A Friday night. It was a Tuesday night at 8 p.m.
There was a long line of students to get in, and so I think a lot of students were being funneled up to the seats on top when the dog pack was full. I mean, it was the most like 2007 that I've seen the arena be like.
I don't think that's the right year.
2006?
Sure. That was Brandon Roy's senior year.
Brandon Roy's senior year where we would go and not be able to sit in the dog pack. And honestly, even then, like we'd go see Arizona and it wasn't as full as it was against Montana in this game. I don't know.
Were there many Montana fans there?
There were many Montana fans there. Huh? And they were all around us cheering loudly for Montana. So it was getting not tense because Montana played incredibly well in this game. Or at least was hitting some lucky threes in the first half and went into the half. Oh, and Isaiah Stewart had three fouls before we were even in the arena, basically.
Love college basketball. Great sport you got going here, guys.
Oh, God, the fouls. Can we just end the foul out rule or get to six in college basketball?
Some of us have been advocating it.
There's a point where you're like, okay, why do we watch college basketball? Right? You're just like, I'm not interested in seeing none of the best players play because all big men get fouls all the time on just soft fouls.
But it's what ensures the great quality and style of play that we see. Mm. Montana, this game, UW won despite 0 of 11 three-point shooting.
Ugh.
Could not find record in Sports References database of the Huskies going over from three-point range. That goes back to the 2010-11 season, so it's been a while.
Marv Harshman days before the three-point line.
And sadly, they do not have a list of games without a three-pointer in the media guide, so I couldn't look up when the last time.
Well, I mean, they did move the three-point line back, 6 inches?
No more than that. Oh, it was a more substantial move than that. But, I mean, that wasn't
So it's just a significantly harder shot for the Huskies, who cannot shoot anything.
They are bad at shooting, but that was also out of the out of character because they didn't shoot 41% on threes on Sunday.
It's kind of crazy. Like, I don't know how that happened, because I look at this team and you're like, wow, Mike Hopkins has assembled a very nice basketball team. He kind of just forgot about the shooting.
I mean, it's a Romar team, my man. I've been saying it for months. It is a late era Romar team, except that the defense is stronger with the 2-3 zone.
At the end of that game, they basically got to the point where the refs are calling a foul on almost every play.
The Huskies attempted 46 free throws.
They were calling a foul on Montana no matter what Montana did.
And Two Montana players fouled out. Four had four fouls.
I empathize with them because it was just like their fouls were, these are so phantom. These refs, it felt like they were not going to let the home team lose that game.
But the defense was strong for the Huskies, held the Grizzlies to 29% two-point shooting. Montana really stated it in the first half with their three-point accuracy, which obviously less sustainable. The San Diego game was the best offensive efficiency of the season for the Huskies by a wide margin, as they shot 65% on twos in addition to the 41% on threes. Jaden McDaniels and Naz Carter both went 5 of 7 on twos, including some more Carter dunks. And Isaiah Stewart went 10 of 17 in dominant performance.
I didn't see any of this game. I forgot that it was even happening.
I streamed part of it both on my ride to the Denver airport and then in the Denver airport was sitting at the gate watching this game.
Wow, I was sitting at home doing nothing.
Yeah.
So
really makes you think.
I was watching the Packers get destroyed by the 49ers.
That game was long over by that, or not long over, but it was over by that.
Yeah, I was literally doing nothing.
Huskies had just 10 turnovers in this one, so similar to the main game, were able to take care of the basketball. And even though he wasn't a big part of the scoring attack that was led by Stewart, a strong game for Quade Green, who had 10 assists and 0 turnovers.
I will say that Quade is looking a lot better.
It turns out that maybe not playing competitive basketball for an entire year was a factor in him starting as poorly as he did.
If he can get into the paint and make floaters and stuff like that, he's going to be a pretty dangerous player. With his ability to distribute, he just wasn't hitting shots for the first couple of games. And as he gets more comfortable and we get toward Pac-12 play, I think Quade is going to be a very important part of this team.
What were your takeaways from seeing Jaden McDaniels in person for the first time, along with Isaiah Stewart, what you saw between the fouls?
I mean, Isaiah Stewart is pretty dominant when he's in the game.
Yeah. Especially against teams like this.
Jaden just takes sometimes such bad shots. I feel like shot selection for him is the number one thing that he could work on. And basically, like there was a three that he threw up where he was barely even looking at the hoop. You know, it was just like, what? Or like a long jumper. I'm like, what are you doing? That's a terrible shot, even if you're the best shooter on the team. And I had a moment where I was like, despite everything else, he's borderline unplayable.
Oh,
that was in this game, and he clearly has played better since then. And I think he settled down a little bit and made some shots. When he's going to the hoop and only shooting wide open jumpers, it's a nice package that Jane offers, and you can see why he's such a good prospect. And again, we've talked extensively. He's very good defensively, very smooth ball movement, but he just needs to know which shots to shoot. And he'll learn that.
Maybe it'll take 5 years into his NBA career, but you know, eventually he'll learn it.
Look, the 2019-2020 Timberwolves are going to the playoffs, so anything's possible.
Brandon Ingram, same thing. He had 10 shot attempts against San Diego. I think that's a good number for him.
Yeah.
Stewart had 18. And Naz also had 10 in that game. So, yeah, that's a reasonable distribution. The Huskies taking with not playing in a holiday tournament, since they're not playing until the next holidays. They're playing over Christmas in Honolulu, taking Thanksgiving week off, and then we'll be back at it on Monday against South Dakota their continuation of this homestand against a lesser competition. It turns out I did not do any research on South
Dakota. Dominating the flyover.
No, South Dakota is actually a little bit better. They're off to a 5-1 start, lost on Friday at Arkansas by 21 points in their toughest test of the young season.
Yeah, but have they played Montana Tech yet?
Yeah, they have not played Montana Tech.
Montana yet. State Gold Mines.
Their best win was at Hawaii, which also, why is South Dakota playing at Hawaii?
Wow.
At UW? I have questions about that. It's an extended road trip this week for them. They're playing Wednesday at Cal Baptist and Saturday at Northern Arizona. And if you can name where Cal Baptist is located, I will be shocked.
Cal Baptist. I'm going to say that's in the Inland Empire.
I don't know if Riverside is in the Inland Empire. Is that?
I think Riverside might be in the Inland Empire.
I'm certainly not ruling it out.
Pause for 25 minutes while we look up the cities in the.
Oh, this is some great podcast geography. Huskies, with those pair of wins over the weekend, moved up two spots in both the AP and the coaches poll to 23rd and 22nd, respectively.
The U.S. Census Bureau defined Riverside, San Bernardino, Ontario metropolitan area.
Well, there you go.
Hello, Inland Empire.
There you go.
Now, the question is, could I name their mascot? Could you name their mascot?
No.
Cal Baptist.
You keep thinking on that one, maybe. UW women's basketball got a 78-46 win, dominant fashion over crosstown rivals Seattle University.
And they're the Lancers.
They are, yes. Now headed to the Puerto Rico Classic, where they will take on Iona, Howard, and Iowa in a tournament that is not actually a tournament. It's just a round robin play.
I don't know why Iona, Howard, and Iowa sound so funny altogether.
It sounds like the worst law firm. I definitely do not want to be represented by the
really
law firm.
It sounds like Iona, a law firm.
Howard and Iowa.
Personal injury attorneys, Iona, Howard, and Iowa.
The fact that it's Iona and Iowa makes it much funnier. Good chance for the Huskies to go 2-1 in this tournament.
Wait. You won't have to pay one iota with Iona, Howard, and Iowa.
So good. That's off the dome. The Huskies will be underdogs against Iowa, which returns two starters from the team that reached the Elite Eight last season behind Megan Gustafson, who's now in the WNBA and was one of the most productive players in women's college basketball last year. But they should be healthy favorites against Iona and Howard. And again, we'll have to pay no money down.
It's not a car dealership.
No, but people are resenting you. That's a fact.
All right, fine, I guess.
There's a joke about this that I just saw online from some sitcom.
You won't get an IOU from Iona, Iowa, Howard, and Iowa.
It's Lionel Hutz. Or maybe it's the other one, but there's commas in there, and it's supposed to say no money down, but it's no comma.
Yeah, no, down. He puts it on his business card. Yeah, no,
exactly.
Money down.
There you go. You're following along. All right, now let's talk about UW football.
Oh, boy.
So, it was a lot of fun being at this game. I'm sure just as fun as it was to watch it at home.
Well, the good thing about being at home is that I was not outside in Colorado.
That's a great point, where it was sub 40 degrees by the end of this one.
Oh, boy. Yeah, the game's starting at
8 p.m.
8 p.m.
Yeah. Not my favorite.
Thanks, Pac-12.
Then the Huskies score 0 points in the first half. And to the extent that they got going offensively in the second half, it wasn't enough. Couldn't pay off the Aaron Fuller extended punt return with a chance to take the lead. Yeah, it really looked like it. And I was thinking before the play, like, oh, this would be a great time. Like, Dante Pettis had that big return here against Colorado. I think that was probably 4 years ago. I think that might have been the all-time record setter for punt return touchdowns.
4 years ago, ain't walking through that door.
I mean, actually, 4 years ago is walking through that door. That was Jake Brady's freshman season.
Okay.
But Biddy Colorado is not walking through that door. And then Colorado able to run out the clock with a successful extended drive starting from their own one-yard line, starting with a Levi Onwuzurike encroachment penalty at the 1 yard line, which the Seahawks had the next day too.
Yeah, that was kind of crazy. Yeah, there were actually a couple of things that felt kind of deja vu between the Seahawks and the Husky games, except for the final score.
Except for the five turnovers by the Eagles. So we probably need to talk about Jacob Eason, right? The Oregon State game. You were able to write off as a fluke. The fact that this happened again against one of the worst defenses in the country is a pretty clear indication that Jacob Eason is not an effective Pac-12 quarterback. He remains 10th in QBR in the conference and is closer to 11th than he is to 9th. And yet he's still projected as a first-round pick, which is quite mystifying.
Well, I think you underestimate how tall and white and big-armed he is.
You know, you just think that at some point scouts are going to actually catch on to the fact that there are other variables, like the ability to perform when pressured in the pocket.
Do you... I know this is like an underground fact. Do you know that Mitchell Trubisky
no.
was drafted ahead of Deshaun Watson and Pat Mahomes?
I've heard that. Did you know that the Bears traded up to get Mitch Trubisky?
I don't know.
They
couldn't
take the risk that he wasn't going to get to the third pick, so they had to trade up to the second pick. Could you imagine what would have happened if the 49ers would have taken him with the second pick?
Wow.
The Bears would never have recovered.
That alternate reality is a reality I would like to live in. But also, I don't know if you've heard this one before. The Jaguars drafted a punter ahead of Russell Wilson.
But he was at least like a punter that they still have on the team, right?
Yeah. He's still down and punts at the one for them.
It's Robo.
Luca was like, he was playing like phone Madden or whatever. And he was like, I have some guy named Anger on my team. And I was like, that guy was drafted ahead of Russell Wilson. He was like, what? He was like, he must be an amazing punter. And I was like, oh no, he's not.
I mean, he was like solid. For
I'm sure he's a very fine punter. Anyway. Congrats to the
Denver Broncos.
No, yeah. They just recently drafted their Eason last year. Do you think they draft one every year?
I think I do. That was my comment after the game. It was like, look, these Buffalo fans are happy now, but just wait until the Broncos draft Jacob Eason.
They're gonna see a return. The next day, the baby put on a Seahawks helmet and was like, I'm Jacob Eason. And I was like, let's go with Jacob Hollister. It's like, I don't really want to hear that name today.
I mean, the thing is, this was completely predictable, and hopefully we've learned some lessons from it.
Okay, I don't want to... Jacob Eason's gotten worse throughout the year.
And that's... It's really just the last 2 weeks. Like, Oregon was arguably his best game of the season when you consider how good that pass defense is. And then the first half of the Utah game was really good. The second half was much less good. But it's the last 2 weeks in particular. And the one thing I don't have a good sense for is this just because of the fact that the scouting report is out and everyone knows, like, just blitz the crap out of Eason and
he
can't beat it?
Very slow.
Although he was kind of fast when he ran.
Was he?
Yeah.
His ability to move around in the pocket.
I was sitting
really
shockingly
bad.
Close. It was very fast in
really?
Person. No, he had Drake heavily throughout the day. But again...
He was moving like a cheetah out there.
No, I mean, it was a 19-yard run. Like, we've never seen him run that far.
I don't even
it's
remember
literally the
run.
Longest he's ever run. It brought him to minus 29 rushing yards on the day.
His feel in the pocket. It's so hard when you live in a city where Russell Wilson plays football to watch almost any other quarterback. Like
people got upset about this with Browning. And
Russell Wilson ruins quarterbacks for you. Right? Like... Russell Wilson's and there's even times where Russ's feel in the pocket is like not perfect, or there's sometimes where you're like, look out behind you or whatever.
I remember like a couple of years ago, like when I went to Seahawks games and fans around us would start to grumble about, come on Russ, why'd you take that sack? And it's like, come on, it's Russell Wilson, what are you doing?
Yeah, he's probably the greatest quarterback we will ever see in our entire lives play for a team.
Yes,
in Seattle.
I got what you were saying.
I have seen Jimmy Garoppolo live. I've
seen college Marcus Mariota live.
God,
still mystified.
I know. If only we could trade Jacob Eason for college Mariota.
That's not how it works. If only we could trade Eason for college Jake Browning.
But his feel in the pocket, just he has no feel in the pocket and he has no touch.
But this is the kind of thing that, like, when you watch him throw and, like, his arm strength is impressive. That's not as obvious, his feel in the pocket. But then when you actually play a real football game, it turns out that how far you throw the ball is not as important as dealing with pressure. Also, I do think he honestly actually struggled with the altitude in this game because he kept overthrowing guys time and again.
That's what I'm wondering about, though. It's just like, I feel like he has really bad touch on his long throws. And
I mean, for most of the year, it's been good. This was an exception in that regard.
It's funny how, because he's like a scout favorite, right? how people blame stat nerds for not watching the football games when really, like, the analytics people literally just judge it by the football games.
Right.
Right? Like, it's the exact opposite. I mean, I guess they're saying that you don't watch them. You just, like, look at it. But it's like...
Oh, believe me, I watched this one.
Scouts are really just judging you, like, in the scenario where you get excited about Jacob Eason, not because of the football game, but because of something that exists completely outside of...
So maybe what they're saying is watch the drill.
Yeah, watch the drill. Like, judging you for something that's completely outside of the sport of football, when it's like, if you can't be pressured and be able to accurately throw a pass, you're not going to be a successful NFL quarterback. Like, we've seen this story before. We know who Blaine Gabbert is.
And you're not going to be a successful college quarterback.
Jacob Eason is not going to be a successful NFL quarterback at this point. However, there's always a however. I don't think Eason was being put into the right situation in this game a lot.
I think it was around the second and 15 run, which then, as I said, Shoddy and Pete Carroll were watching that, and they were like jealous, like, ah, Bush Hamden got to call a second and 15 run. Hey, wish we could.
Sometimes Rashad Penny runs for touchdowns on this.
He sure does sometimes. And then, look, Bush Hamden can't call plays for this team anymore.
Okay, I was going to say, are we going to have the Bush Hamden conversation?
Yeah.
What are the chances that he's back as offensive coordinator next year?
85%.
Really?
Yeah.
85%? There are going to be changes on this coaching staff after the season.
I think it's possible he remains offensive coordinator but loses play calling duties.
And who does that go to?
That's more plausible.
Jimmy Lake? Like, yeah. What does that mean? I would be very surprised. Like, Coach Pete ain't calling the plays. You think they're going to give it to the quarterback's coach?
Maybe you bring in someone new at one of the, you know, positions.
Or Tedford!
Our kingdom for Jeff Tedford.
But look, like, there's important lessons here.
Like, everyone was so upset about the play calling with Jonathan Smith, and then he went to Oregon State, and they scored, like, 53 points a game. I mean, granted, against the Wazoo defense, but... Or 52, I guess they needed
53. Yeah, they didn't quite get to 53.
Yeah, that was a crucial lag of a point there. Although, I guess they could have picked an extra point. Everyone was so upset about Jake Browning because he doesn't throw the ball hard enough. Guess what? Doesn't matter. And it does matter, but it's not as important as all the other things that Jake Browning did that made him the most winningest quarterback in program history. And maybe let's not be so quick to just dismiss this. And here's my other complaint now. Like, it's a bad season. It's a very disappointing season. They have not played up to the talent level they have. They have not even played up to the level they've played at times this season. But let's all, like, take a step back. Like, people are like, oh, this is a terrible season.
Yeah, it's like, guys, the Coach Pete takes are getting a little too
hot. We're 11 years removed from 0-12. Like, there's still, by advanced metrics, a top 25 team in the country. And we are smart enough to know that that's ridiculous and that that 14-point line was a joke.
I don't know, though. It's just kind of like there's no answer for why they're not better. You know what I mean? Like,
I think there are a few answers for it.
Why couldn't they run the ball in this game?
I think that's because of the fact that Colorado was daring them to beat them through the air.
There's something about it where it's like, what happened? And I feel like
the loss of Jackson Kirkland may have been a factor there. I don't know.
The line looked really bad for the entire game. I just, like, Eason was pressured so quickly a lot of the time.
But there also wasn't a plan to deal with the pressure. And that is a case where I think it is on Hamden for sure.
When they threw the ball up the seam to Hunter Bryant, it worked incredibly well.
Like, that was only happening on, you know, non-obvious passing situations.
Can we get some play action in the house?
There was some
of and it. Also end the long extended handoffs. Like, that is the thing that they kept going to, where Eason is like moving way out to handoff. I'm like, oh, that's a play action. Because if that was the Seahawks, that's a play action 100%
of the time. 100%
of the time.
Because you have to keep it honest. You have to.
Statistically
have
speaking,
play.
You actually don't.
I know you don't.
You could
that's
play action
how
on every
it.
Play.
That's how they view it.
But. Those plays never work for them. And they did not work at all in this game. They kept running them. I'm like, oh, thank God. What? But even like the trick plays that they tried out, it was like
I still think they have to be tripping plays because, like, everyone always knows what's coming on
those plays. How was there pressure on Jacob Eason on the flea flicker? Like, what in the world. We saw Russell Wilson on a flea flicker. Russell Wilson is one of the most dangerous quarterbacks in all of the NFL, playing against a very good NFL defense, and they still didn't have pressure on him on a flea flicker. Colorado knew it was coming.
Did have double coverage on Malik Turner until Wilson dropped the perfect throw in there. Yeah, I that's the other theory I have, is that they're tipping their plays somehow.
Bush Hamden's probably agent of the other team.
How much would it?
He's probably throwing the season.
How much would it explain if they were like other teams had cracked their play calls? Like, it would totally explain a lot of the season, wouldn't it?
I've cracked their play calls. They're bad.
Just BYU's defense isn't good enough to stop them, even if they know the play is coming. I don't know. But
it was just like, it was clear that this was their version of putting in Jake Haener, was running the wide receiver pass and the flea flicker. They were like, we need something to happen here, and we don't know what to do. The only answer to that is not having Bush Hamden call plays.
I mentioned it on Twitter, but there were so many snarky tweets that I was unable to send to this game because I did not have a signal in my seat.
Oh.
The only tweet I could send is when I went up to the concourse at halftime.
You should have been standing at the concourse the whole time.
My commitment to tweeting was not strong. That was my commitment to being the one person there trying to make some noise for the Huskies. I mean, we weren't in the UW section, but there were a lot of other Husky fans around me, and there was not a lot of them making noise.
Maybe it's because they were 6-4 after losses to Stanford and Cal.
I'm sorry. Is the line compete if you're not 6-4 with losses to Stanford? It's always compete. Well, you don't need to be extra about it, but you can still make noise on key third downs. It's not too much to ask. So the Apple Cup is a game that's happening this Friday between a pair of 6-5 teams, one of whom is substantially happier to be 6-5. The Cougs assured bowl eligibility by...
Sure that they're happy to be 6-5? Because they were pretty damn good last year.
I said somewhat more happy to be 6-5 because they got there by erasing an 11-point deficit in the final 2 minutes and 10 seconds of Saturday's game versus Oregon State on senior day, where the Cougars honored the late Tyler Helinski, who would have been a senior this year, had his parents in attendance. So a very emotional victory for Wazoo, which is 5-1 at home, have not won a Pac-12 road game. Their only road win was at Houston in what was technically a neutral site game, but was played in Houston. They are number 27 in FPI, much like the Huskies, rate much better statistically than by, you know, the conventional wisdom around the team. But a more imbalanced split between their units than the Huskies have. This is the number 6 offense in the country, the best in terms of FPI efficiency, the best offense of Mike Leach's tenure at Washington State. And yet they are 6-5 because their defense ranks 108th in the country in FPI efficiency. And they are also typically mediocre on special teams at 52nd. I think there is a strong case that Anthony Gordon is having the best season ever by a Mike Leach quarterback.
Wow.
Which seems preposterous.
That's Minsanity.
He is number 1 among all Leach quarterbacks in yards per attempt at 8.4. Minshew averaged 7.2 last year. He is number 2 in completion percentage among Leach quarterbacks with at least 200 attempts in a season. This is season by season, not career. And number 5 in yards per completion. Now, you can make a strong case also for Graham Harrell, who had a similar completion percentage and yards per completion, but threw fewer interceptions in 2008 at Texas Tech. And Gordon's only been middle of the pack in terms of avoiding interceptions. But Gordon has the highest QBR of any Leach QB at Wazoo.
Wow.
It is also becoming increasingly clear that Max Borgi is the best running back that Leach has had at Wazoo. His 740 rushing yards and 6.7 yards per attempt are the most of any running back in that span.
Oh, Belichick is salivating.
And a strong receiving threat, too. Love the Christian McCaffrey comparisons for Max Borgi. Love him. So, one thing I wanted to look at ahead of this game is UW's defense against the Wazoo offense since Chris Peterson came to town with Pete Kwiatkowski. And was Jimmy Lake on the original staff? I think so, as a defensive back coach. I think he's been here the entire time, not necessarily as co-defensive coordinator. In those games, if you wait based on the season averages of the quarterbacks who have played against UW to account for the fact that Peyton Bender started a game, that was really rough go for the Cougs there. They are completing passes at a relatively similar rate to their overall average, 62.4% versus a weighted 64.2% in other games. but for just 9.0 yards per completion, down from 10.9, so almost two fewer yards per completion. And they're throwing interceptions on 4.6% of their passes, up from a weighted 2.9%. They have had at least two interceptions in every Apple Cup in that space.
Wow. Well, I mean, yes, it's worse, but also, like, you're saying this as if it's like Chris Peterson's scheme is better against them, but this is the best secondary consistently that they've played.
I still think that there's, like, other schools have had success against UW's secondary in the span. A lot of them have this year.
But I'm saying, you're talking about historically, this isn't this year. There are not teams that are playing against Kevin King, against Taylor Rapp, against Byron Murphy, right?
But other teams have had success, and Wazoo never has. And Jimmy Lake had some thoughts about this last year. We know what type of offense that we're playing. They do the same thing year in and year out. This is 5 years in a row now, so it makes it really easy to game plan when an offense does the same thing every year. Obviously, now with the conditions that was referring to last year's snow, and they can do only one thing, that handcuffs you a little bit. So it was definitely to our advantage, and we took advantage of it. The follow-up question was, are you surprised they haven't tried any adjustments in 5 years? It does surprise me. But knowing what I read about the head football coach there, he does things a little bit different way. So hopefully he remains here for a long time. And that would be awesome. Not my favorite Jimmy Lake quote, but also my favorite Jimmy Lake quote.
I mean, let's see what happens after this game, because I do think this is a bit of a different Cougar attack. What Max Borgi is adding is a little bit more than any running back out of the backfield, especially receiving, has done for the Cougs in this time period. Also, there are no first-round picks on that secondary right now. There are no second-round picks on that secondary right now. You're going to be looking at Kyler Gordon matched up with these players.
Gordon played like two or three snaps on defense.
Okay, you're going to look at Trent McDuffie matched up with these players. Like, this is not the same kind of secondary that you had in the past, Jimmy Lake. It's a transition year, and these players may grow into very excellent players in the secondary, but this season, where they're at right now, is the worst secondary that the Huskies have had of the Chris Peterson era.
I don't know if it's worse than the first year after Marcus Peters left the team or got kicked off the team. I mean, you did still have Shaq Thompson in the mix at that point, so that was
pretty good. He was a running back that year.
He once was me.
Memories. Anyway, I'm just saying you can't approach it in the same way that you would when you had players. Like
I think this is then the greatest test of, does UW just completely own the air raid offense?
Well, I mean, you're also talking about a team that has only won one road game all year, like...
Well, the reason they've only won one, we're going to talk about that. That's the defense again. Okay. The reason for that.
Yes. The Huskies are going to give up points in this game.
Yes, I agree with that. I think this will be Wazoo's best offensive game of the since Chris Peterson has arrived at UW in the Apple Cup. The Cougars are giving up 5.0 yards per carry, which ranks last in the Pac-12, and also 8.8 yards per pass attempt, which ranks 11th, better than only UCLA. So... the bad news is, again, UW has played terrible defenses the last two games in Oregon State and Colorado and has scored a combined 21 offensive points in that span, which is not ideal. I don't know how well UW will pass the ball in this game. I do suspect they will be able to run the ball effectively, and that will be a difference maker as compared to last week.
I suspected that last week, though.
I mean, I don't know that I had any specific suspicions about how they were going to run the ball against Colorado.
Especially with Newton back and the whole group of running backs back, it didn't make sense
Sean McGrew? It's a baffling that...
I thought that was kind of strange.
He's playing special teams, but he's been behind Kamari Pleasant in the rotation. Maybe it's just it is a health thing, but there's no merit explanation for Kamari Pleasant to be playing snaps.
The running shouldn't have been as bad as it was against Colorado, though.
I mean, probably not, but I don't think Colorado had like a notably bad rush defense. They are, well, 9th in the Pac-12.
It didn't make sense. And so you would assume that going into this Wazoo game, but at this point, I don't think we can approach any game with the normal level of logic that you would.
We can no longer take anything for granted.
We can't. We can't just go into a game saying the Huskies will play well on offense or will run the ball well, because they just haven't consistently done anything well on offense the entire season.
But they did run the ball well in the Oregon State game against a run defense that's middle of the pack in the Pac-12. middle of the Pac-12. So it's only a one-week situation with the running games. It's a two-week situation with the passing game being execrable. Is that how you pronounce that word? I don't know.
The word that you just made up?
No, that's a real one. I know how to spell it. I just don't know how to pronounce it.
Okay.
Any other thoughts on this game?
We'll see what happens.
I'm very excited for this game.
It'll be a fun hang. I'm excited because it's the Apple Cup. It'll be a fun game to go to. It'll be cold and clear. It'll be a good day to go to college football. Thanksgiving weekend is always exciting. You know, we'll be recounting how delicious our top five Thanksgiving foods were, as discussed with Nate Duncan at the end of this podcast.
Another plug for a mid-show plug.
And then we'll watch a football game.
I mean, there was one other factor we should discuss in the Colorado loss.
What is that?
That's the listener.
Ugh.
The listener made the red trap. You were trying to blame this on me, but I have the UW lost the Rose Bowl to Ohio State, which is a very good team.
On a sometimes neutral I watch field. Dwayne Haskins and I'm like,
you know, he was playing under very different conditions last year.
I know.
Much better talent around him.
I know. Does.
Not in a relative sense. I mean in an absolute sense.
Who did they beat yesterday?
Washington?
Yeah.
I don't know, but they were very bad.
They beat a team.
Was it Detroit? It wasn't Detroit.
Was it? I think it was the Jeff Driscoll-led Detroit Lions.
And very, very strongly considered starting Jeff Driscoll in fantasy this week.
Are you really?
No, last week. But I was going to start him over Dak, which I think probably would have worked out as it turned out.
There had to be a better quarterback on the waiver wire.
Well, Jameis Winston was out there, but someone grabbed him ahead of him.
Oh.
Could have seen him throw the multiple interceptions.
But watching, Chase Young was better than any player on the field in that Washington-Detroit game that happened. Which I don't even remember him from the Husky, from the Rose Bowl, really.
Yeah, me neither.
But I was just like, that guy destroyed us?
I mean, you know, he didn't even destroy UW in the second half.
I know.
Anyways, I went to that loss, but in terms of true road games, before this one, I was 3-0 all time, the 2000 Apple Cup. The Cal game in 2016, and then the last Colorado trip in 2017. So you can't put this on me, but sadly you can put it on the listener. Our friends, Nate, Tyler, Alicia, and Lexi, made the trip, and as they often have proven to be, it was an unsuccessful trip. Nate, third Belton brother Nate Taggart, now 1-10 all time in road or neutral site games. I think we have to prevent them from traveling again.
Look, Nate's Pelton cast egotted, right? He hasn't guessed it on Talk and Taco Time yet.
We still need to do that.
Okay.
We never had
that's the T in egot.
sure is.
He's participated. He's judged Seattle's best foods. He's been a third Pelton brother talking about football. He was at Pelton cast. He's been at multiple Pelton cast lives. He was
at. I didn't know they're called Pelton casts live.
He was at Pelton Cast Trivia.
Yeah.
And
won that one.
If he really wants to Pelton Cast EGOT, stop going to games. That's how you really do it.
I mean, I really enjoyed
hanging out. Do us a favor and don't go to any more road games.
Really enjoyed hanging out with them before the game on Saturday, but yeah. Yeah, it's not great. Chances of victory for this game, knowing that I will not be going up to the 300 level to go sit with them, is that the Cal and Utah losses?
You go first.
The Huskies are 6.5-point favorites in this game. I'm going to say 65%.
Are you a goat wearing pajamas in my front yard? Because that chance of victory is inflated, good sir.
Wait, what? This is new? It's next to the turkey?
The turkey is gone.
Oh, the turkey? What, did the turkey get destroyed?
The turkey stopped working.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that line.
Okay.
I feel a lot less confident about this game.
I mean, you correctly felt a lot less confident about last game, right?
Did I? I predicted.
Or did you? I don't know.
Morning. I'm pretty sure I was more positive than you.
Yeah.
I'm going to say 55%.
You were exactly 5% more positive than I was. Let's wrap things up with the Seahawks, who got that 17-9 win Sunday at Philadelphia to improve to 9-2 and now have a long week over Thanksgiving as they prepare for Monday Night Football against the Minnesota Vikings in a matchup of the two teams who would be the NFC wildcards if the season ended today. First, coming out of that game, notable topics. I mean, well, I guess just, is there anything else on that game that we haven't touched on that we should get into? Are you concerned at all about the fact that the passing, you had the drops with DK and Metcalf, that Russell Wilson barely completed half of his passes? Are these concerning to you?
No.
I mean, it's...
Are they concerning to you?
It's pretty, I mean, not the drop specifically, but it's pretty much what I predicted. Like, I feel like we both had elements of last week's
take. Oh, yeah, we were talking this morning. I was like, wow, you were really right about that Eagles secondary.
And I was like, well, you were right about it being a good matchup for the Seahawks.
Defense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's the most that we've ever agreed. And we said, Pelton brothers, unite.
I think a big takeaway from this game was the success of the Seahawks pressure, playing without Jadeveon Clowney, who has an injury related to a sports hernia that caused him to travel to Philadelphia ahead of the team to see a specialist and then sit this game out. Pete Carroll did relay Monday that Clowney is feeling, quote, pretty good after treatment and looking forward to playing on Monday Night Football.
Where did this injury come from?
I think he suffered in the San Francisco game, but it wasn't necessarily clear until after the bye week how serious it was.
Interesting.
So, oh, I guess we haven't talked about the fact that Ed Dixon went back on IR. That was a bit of a bummer.
I didn't even know that happened.
You missed that?
Yeah.
He practiced for a day.
And what a day it was.
Presumably re-aggravated the injury and wow. Then was placed back on IR, ending his season. So Tyrone Swoops was promoted for off the practice squad.
I saw Swoops in there.
And for a period of time during this game, when Jacob Hollister went out with a foot injury that doesn't appear serious, was the only active tight end for the Seahawks for a bit there. But Hollister was able to come back in the game and remain effective.
Don't you forget about George Fant. Don't you ever forget about George Fant.
I'm just not listing him as a tight end. Luke Wilson may be able to come back from his hamstring injury this week. Then on the defensive line, which again played well in this game, that happened despite the fact that Jaron Reed re-injured his previous ankle sprain and left the game. And it sounds less likely than Clowney that he'll be back next Monday night. But the Seahawks got a breakout game from Ezekiel Ansah, who Pete Carroll mentioned on his Monday radio show, feeling stronger after they put him on a new regimen to bulk up after the weight he'd lost rehabbing his off-season surgery.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that was encouraging. There's like a justification for why he was so effective right away. And then the interior pressure that they got, even without Reed, with Quentin Jefferson in the middle, Puna Ford, you know, that was a big factor in this one, along with the Eagles' injuries on the offensive line.
Which may have been a bigger factor. We don't really know. I mean, we'll probably find out on Monday.
Yeah, it's tough to say without that.
But we are starting to get a little bit more evidence that the defense is getting quite a bit better.
I mean, I think it's the combination of the fact that you are finally getting pressure, which, by the way, we didn't talk about this in the UW segment. Part of the reason the defense regressed so much from the Oregon State game, which was so strong, is after getting some great pressure from Joe Tryon in particular in that game, got zero pressure on Steven Montez, who just scrambled any time that they did get pressure. And that's something that in the past that has been important for their defense in the Apple Cup. It's like, it's in like one-man wrecking crew so that they can get pressure without blitzing. And it was like, you know, it was our guy Vita Vea who twisted the touchdown.
Got a touchdown. I saw that. Hearing Danny Shelton just like messed up, stuff up wrecking on the Patriots D-line. Like, good God.
And then it was Tryon last year in a breakout game in the snow in the Apple Cup. So we'll see if he and Levi Onwuzurike can provide that kind of pressure again this year. But on the Seahawks standpoint, like, yeah, it was definitely very encouraging to see. And then also Quandre Diggs, his presence in the secondary.
Yeah, I mean, the D-line, every single player not named LJ Collier was a factor in this game.
Oh, no.
When I saw that he played 26 snaps, I was just like...
Yeah, I don't remember him. Get out there. We also saw in the defense a change because in relation to that Ed Dixon move, when they activated from IR, him from IR, they made room by waiving Jamar Taylor after his struggles at nickel corner in the Monday Night Football game against San Francisco. And we thought it was going to be Ugo Amadi there getting the snaps, but it really ended up being Akeem King.
Well, and also a lot of the sort of base defense also that we talked about.
Yeah, not surprising.
It was going to be necessary in this game.
So this will be a test, I think, of whether the Seahawks' defensive improvement is for real. The Vikings were number 7 in DVOA entry in last weekend, a spot ahead, or I guess, I don't know, where they're one spot ahead of the Seahawks, but I have it written down that the Vikings were 7th and the Seahawks were 9th, which cannot possibly be true. Both of those things. Vikings a bit more balanced. They rank 6th on offense, 7th on defense, 18th in special teams. It's, of course, the second consecutive time these teams have met on Monday Night Football. In December, the Seahawks won 21-7 last year, prompting the Vikings to fire offensive coordinator John DeFilippo and replace him with Kevin Stefanski. That move has worked out very well for them. There's been some growing pains again with Kirk Cousins early in this season, but since about week 4 or 5, they've really been able to establish the combination of the run-first offense that they want, because of the fact that the Vikings are aspiring to be the Seahawks. It's the Vikings are the Seahawks are the Cowboys, is both Mina Kimes and Ben Baldwin posted about last week. But then combining that with a heavy dose of play action that has made Kirk Cousins so effective. Cousins has emerged now as one of the NFL's most effective QBs after that disappointing last season that included a 20 of 33 day for 208 yards with a lost fumble in Seattle. He is number 2 behind Patrick Mahomes among qualifying quarterbacks in yards per attempt this season, number 2 in completion percentage over expectation, and number 3 in expected points added. He's been doing it without Adam Thielen, who's barely played in the last 5 weeks due to a hamstring injury, just 16 total snaps over that span, including 7 in week 9 before re-aggravating the injury. Not much info today on his status coming off the bye, but seems likely he'll be able to return this week against the Seahawks. They haven't missed a beat without him, largely because Stephon Diggs has been so dominant. He's averaging 92 yards per game in Thielen over the last 5 weeks, and an incredible 14.8 yards per target during that span. He's number 1 overall in DVOA entering last week, and 6th in DR value stat. He's essentially having Tyler Lockett's 2018 season, where you have huge efficiency on not as much volume as some of the number 1 receivers in the NFL. In Thielen's absence, B.C. Johnson has not been particularly effective as his replacement as a starting receiver, averaging just 5.2 yards per target. He was more effective in the number 3 role playing in the slot. The Vikings also used a lot more 12 personnel in Thielen's absence, playing rookie Irv Smith Jr. alongside veteran Kyle Rudolph. As far as that running attack, Dalvin Cook is enjoying his first full healthy season in the NFL and has really been outstanding. He's number 3 entering last week among running backs in both rushing and receiving DR, according to Football Outsiders metrics. Defensively, the Vikings about average in terms of pass defense, number 5 in rush defense, which was really a priority for them after the Seahawks game. The Seahawks ran for 214 yards in that game, winning with Russell Wilson throwing for less than 100 yards in that game. The Vikings have not allowed more than 147 rushing yards in a game this entire season. It's intriguing, though, that their defense has, their cornerbacks have not, typically a strength of this Vikings team, have not really been necessarily this season. According to Pro Football Reference's tracking, opponents are completing 80% of their passes against Xavier Rhodes, the most against any player who's defended at least 50 targets. And his 55 completions allowed were second most in the league through week 11, with Trey Wayne 5th at 53 on the other side of the field for these Vikings. So that definitely an area the Seahawks can attack, depending on how effective receiver play they're going to get this week.
Well, and that's definitely encouraging to hear, whereas like this Vikings team has definitely been a fairly good secondary. And you look at it and you're like, where is the thing that the Seahawks can take advantage of? Right? Like, what is the place where the Seahawks are better than the Vikings are at? Because they are this balanced team, right? And defensively, you can tell that the Seahawks are going to have trouble with this team, right? They're going to sell out against the run. We know what's going to happen. They're scared of Dalvin Cook. Every single second of this week, they're thinking, don't let them run on us. 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 Don't let them run on us, right? It's all that they care about. But this isn't the Eagles with no wide receivers walking through the door, right? This is a team with a very good quarterback.
This isn't the Eagles with Carson Wentz walking through that door.
Oh, wow.
I think it was much more on Carson Wentz but than also, the receiving corps.
It was on Carson Wentz, and it was on the game plan, and everything was wrong in that game. It was on their offensive line. The Vikings are uniquely suited offensively to give the Seahawks trouble.
Because of the fact that they play like the Seahawks?
Yes. Huh. And because all that the Seahawks care about is stopping the run. I think that the corners, we haven't seen them against...
I don't think it's all they care
about. We haven't seen
them
against a good offense yet with Quandre Diggs. no, I mean,
we've seen them against a good offense. We haven't seen them against a good quarterback.
There we go. I mean, that could be what this game comes down to. And the Seahawks have had very good turnover luck the last couple of weeks and have really turned those into big plays. If Kirk Cousins is not going to make as many mistakes as Jimmy Garoppolo did.
Yes.
Kirk Cousins is a better quarterback than Jimmy Garoppolo is. Kirk Cousins is a better quarterback than Carson Wentz is. Kirk Cousins is... I was talking to a friend of mine today who works in my building and is also a Vikings fan. And I was really... I think Vikings fans are like not really sold on the Kirk Cousins experience.
I think understandably. It didn't go super great in year one.
Aside from Lamar Jackson... He is the best quarterback that they have played so far this year.
Oh, yeah.
And will play so far this year.
Yeah.
And even Lamar Jackson obviously adds a different element, but it's like if they're leaving players wide open in situations where they definitely left players wide open in a lot of the games that they weren't kind of as abused by it, but if their defense looks like it did against Atlanta or something like that, the Vikings are going to score 40 points in this game.
That game will be too slow-paced for that. These teams both want to run the ball a lot.
But it's like, the play action is going to work very well against
this is a week we're
going to
lose. But you know, if you still are playing, if Quandre Diggs is able to take away a large part of the center field in the way that we've seen in the last two games, and, you know, again, this is the toughest test, then you take away the deep plays on play action, and you can at least make it a manageable, like, you know, force them to kind of grind out possessions, which is what Pete Carroll philosophically wants to do on defense.
Make them grind out possessions.
Yeah,
yes.
And count on them to just eventually make a mistake.
I do think at the same time that the Seahawks secondary probably will play well against these receivers. Diggs is a concern, obviously. But they don't have the ability to sort of take advantage of that Seahawks base defense that some of the other teams they've played have. They don't have like an amazing tight end. Dalvin Cook is nice coming out of the backfield, but I like Michael Kendricks' ability to sort of clean that stuff up. You don't agree with that?
No, I've seen something else.
You were scoffing.
Doing additional research. No, I was not scoffing.
So there could be ways that the Seahawks base defense, especially with Diggs, plays well. And they've looked very good since Diggs. I mean, he adds a different element in the secondary, at the back end of that secondary, that anybody has had on this team this year.
The disturbing news is that, yes, I was looking at the forecast, which I thought was all sunny for like an extended period of time.
No.
And now the forecast, I was looking at Sunday. Okay, it's Monday, partly cloudy.
Oh, partly
cloudy.
There's
some chance of rain.
No, that's fine.
I mean, we're still a week out, so
the thing
can
that
change.
Russell Wilson can't handle is weather. He can handle partly cloudy. Russ just can't handle weather.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm just saying, I was looking at PM showers on Sunday, which would have been bad if this were a Sunday night game.
Okay, so Monday we're fine with.
That's the reaction I had that you thought was me scoffing at Kyle or at Michael Kendricks covering Dalvin Cook or whatever.
And if they are able to take advantage of this Vikings secondary,
the Seahawks' advantage is they're playing at home in a night game.
Yes, the part that you had to add was in a night game, because Seahawks playing at home this year.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
They have not played very well at home. I mean, the losses have been against very good teams, and now that we see what the Ravens have become, maybe the best of teams.
The best of teams. The greatest team of all time, the 2019 Baltimore Ravens.
I've learned that from a football analyst, that the current 49ers are like the 2013 Seahawks defense combined with the 2018 Rams offense.
Huh. I missed that one.
From a former NFL quarterback turned analyst who predicted that Carson Wentz would come alive in the second half against the Seahawks.
Still time. One of the things I was looking at last week is like how meaningful the 10 a.m. start time was for the Seahawks. And it means something, but it doesn't seem like it means that much compared to playing at 1 p.m. But do you know what is a huge difference?
What is that?
East Coast teams playing in the night game against West Coast teams, it's a huge advantage for the West Coast team. I was looking at this specifically, like West teams going east, but there's like no home field at all over the last 10 years in those games, which is a relatively small sample. But
of night games.
Yeah. And I think the same thing generally holds true when those east teams go west to play in a night game. And that's probably part of the reason that the Seahawks historically have had such a good record in night games, along with just being a good team.
And this crowd is going to be pumped and jacked for this one. 9-2 Seahawks against the Vikings, especially if the Ravens are able to knock off the Niners the day before with a chance at the 1 or 2 seed on the line. Like, this is, it's going to be a very fun game. It's going to be a pretty incredible environment. That does make sense, though. I hadn't thought about that. But also, you have to consider, like, I mean, man, these Pac-12 teams, like, looking at the stats of, like, how time affects players, these Pac-12 teams that have to just play at all random times every week.
Wait. To be clear here, this is not unique to the Pac-12. Every conference plays games at 8 p.m. It's just those games aren't at 8 p.m. Pacific time. They're at 8 p.m. Eastern and 5 p.m. Pacific.
Oh, and I suppose what you're saying is the bigger issue here is time zones. Because the Seahawks are playing it.
And that's the thing, is that Pac-12 teams are playing against each other. They're both on the same time. Yes.
Well, I mean, there are different time zones in the Pac-12. But
there's one different time zone, yes. That two and sometimes three teams play, or two and sometimes four teams play it.
But for the Vikings, they're starting this game at 7:20, whereas the Seahawks are starting it at 5:20.
Yes, and that does look to be a sizable difference in terms of home field advantage. So, yet despite that, an interesting line, Seahawks by 3 in this game, which I don't know if that indicates that Vegas sees these as even teams on a neutral field, which I guess is
I mean, about there's right. almost no way to see this as anything but even teams.
Yeah.
And it really just depends on how much it's strange to think that we would look at home field advantage and be like, it's not that big of an advantage.
Well, I mean, 3 is about what it is. So historically, it's
but by the spread, but like when you're thinking about it, sort of like how you feel about the game, I'm like, in the past, if there would have been a big game at home on Monday night, I would have been like, there's no chance of losing this game. And that's not the way that I approach this Vikings game.
Me neither. But I do feel like that's an important edge.
So, if they can get Russ cooking in this one, which it seems like the Vikings secondary will give him a little bit of space to do, get the ball to the wide receivers.
I mean, we could overstate this. Like, they're not bad in the secondary. We're not talking about the Tampa Bay Buccaneers here, who, by the way, the Seahawks struggled against at times in that game before getting it cooking.
But I think we could see sort of a comeback game for DK. I mean, getting the ball into Tyler Lockett a little bit more as he gets healthier. Pete talked about how his injury was something that's going to get behind him. He won't be 100% by Monday night, but he's going to be a lot closer than he was yesterday.
And then maybe Josh Gordon more involved.
And also getting Josh Gordon more involved than the one catch that he had. Very nice one catch. But you saw some of those plays against the Eagles secondary, and it's like these sacks happened because there was nowhere to go for Russell on these passes, and I don't think that will be the case against this Viking secondary.
And they're pretty average in terms of pass rush, Minnesota, so not a big factor in this game necessarily.
All right.
Chances of victory?
65%.
Wow, it's me more pessimistic than you weak. I'm going with 60%.
I was more pessimistic than you about the...
Oh, you're right. That's our usual 5% split. What am I talking about?
I think I was 10% lower for the Huskies.
Yeah. I'm wildly off there. Well, on that note, I want to say that as we head into Thanksgiving, as always, we are thankful for you, the listener. You have nothing else to add to that? You're not thankful?
No, you already said it. You said we.
Okay.
You speak for both of us.
I thought you were going to add on something.
Let me add also that we're thankful for you, the listener. I just really wanted to throw in there that, we're thankful for you, the listener.
So we hope everybody has a happy Thanksgiving weekend and enjoys some sports this weekend. And now with that, it's time to revisit our ranking of top 5 Thanksgiving feeds. And now with that, it's time to revisit our ranking of top 5 Thanksgiving foods with Nate Duncan.
You want to try that one more time?
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are joined by one of the most popular Third Pelton brothers in the history of the Peltoncast, a star podcaster in his own right. You know him from the Dunked On Basketball NBA podcast. Please welcome back to the show to share his food expertise with us once again, Nate Duncan.
Well, I wasn't popular enough that Tristan actually was able to make time to go out for burgers with me the last time I was in Seattle.
You're popular as far as a podcaster goes.
Yeah, that's right. People like me much better if they don't have to actually see me in person, I think, is what I'm learning here.
No, I severely regret not being able to do that. It was one of my biggest regrets from this last summer. But I hope that, you know, the food podcasting will extend even beyond what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, that is my hope as well.
Yeah, I mean, first off, when we start doing TJ's Today or Trader Bros or Trader Joe's podcast, obviously Nate will be a frequent guest on that pod. But that's not what we're here to discuss today. We're here to discuss the holiday that is coming later this week, and that is Thanksgiving. And the food is a crucial part of Thanksgiving, so we wanted to count down in classic Peltoncast fashion our top five Thanksgiving foods. Something we actually did on this podcast during its very first year, way back in 2013. And it was interesting to go back, and I compared, and my list has changed. So I'm curious to see whether yours has changed, Tristan.
The takes are hotter.
Meteoric growth of the podcast has changed your tastes. You're just truffled gravy and caviar turkey is all you have these days.
That's interesting. Those did not crack my top five.
All of mine are much more burger-related now. I literally just got finished eating a Thanksgiving burger, so I'm trying to combine everything.
Do you want to give your review here? You gave it on Twitter, but do you want to give your review of that burger here on the pod?
It was excellent. I mean, I've always wanted a burger to have gravy on it, and that finally happened for me today.
Should we talk a little about Thanksgiving in general, maybe quickly? Nate, I know when I first approached you about this, you had said you had some unorthodox Thanksgiving food takes.
Well, I guess I'm just really I'll spoil my list probably if I explain what those are. But I will say that Thanksgiving may, in fact, be my favorite holiday.
Yes,
that's good. That's good. Yeah, I mean, definitely from an eating perspective, it's the best.
Well, I would say from that standpoint. Also, just it's not like just deathly cold if you're in like a cold climate yet. There's some solid sports going on. And also, you get 4 full days off, which is really the only holiday where you're guaranteed to get that each year.
Right. Many people do get that break between Christmas and New Year's, but not everyone. All right. So I guess let's get into it. Nate, you're the guest. So let's start off with your number 5 Thanksgiving food.
Let's see. Number 5. I guess I would have to go with, maybe it's controversial because it's not a traditional Thanksgiving food, but macaroni and cheese.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's controversial. I don't think I've ever had mac and cheese at our Thanksgiving, so I couldn't put it on the list. But if we did have it, I'm sure it would be in my top 5.
I mean, mac and cheese is just a good food in general.
Sure. And it's just like it adds to the idea of Thanksgiving, which is just way more starch than you need. It's just like... Like every single side dish is just like this massive amount of starch. Like that's one thing that I like about Thanksgiving is like regular vegetables really are relegated to the sidelines. And it's all just like meat and starch, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's you're loading up for the long winter. All right, Tristan, what did you have in your number 5 spot?
So I went with number 5 as kind of the capper to my list, which would be the capper to the Thanksgiving meal. And I went with pumpkin pie at the number 5 spot.
Probably like carrot cake too, don't you?
No, don't like carrot cake, but I was saying I could see a sweet potato pie here also.
Oh, spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
And the perfect way to eat a pumpkin pie or a sweet potato pie is with vanilla bean ice cream on the side.
On the not on top?
Around it. In the general area.
I can't, like, this is just a general issue that I have with desserts is that the idea of we're going to take something that on its own isn't a dessert and isn't sweet, and then we're going to put a crap load of sugar on it and put it into like a pie or a cake, and now we're going to call it a dessert. Like carrot cake, pumpkin pie, sweet potato pie, like all these things are not like actually dessert foods, and now you're just adding a bunch of sugar to make it a dessert food. Noodle kugel is like that too. You guys probably don't know what that is, but like, in the realm of Jewish foods, it falls into that category as well. It's basically like a sugary, like noodle based dessert. So, in general, carrot cake, of course, is like the most egregious offender in that category.
I would agree with that because, I mean, at least pumpkins, they're not like full on savory. Like they're still more in the sweet family. And I would say that's certainly true, obviously, of sweet potatoes. Carrots, them in sweet is incompatible to me. So I will not eat carrot cake.
Yeah, I mean, at any time you can take something that's basically inedible as a raw food and put it into a pie, you have to do it.
But Nate's really not going to like my list. So in the number five spot.
Wait, I had a question for Nate first. Nate, it's Thanksgiving at the Duncan household. What are you having for dessert?
You know what? I'm so locked in on some of my favorites that I don't even really have much dessert. You know, there'll be some pumpkin pie. Usually my uncle, who like can't cook at all, he and his wife like can't really cook at all, so they'll like go to like Baker's Square, which is, you know, a pretty like mediocre pie place, and like bring over a bunch of pies. So that'll usually be the dessert here. But I'm just not focused on dessert at Thanksgiving time. The rest of the food is just too good. The opportunity cost is just too high.
I can respect that. All right, in my number five spot, I had rolls, which I think are. I know that you're going to be upset, Tristan, but I think they're an important part of a quality Thanksgiving meal, but I think they're more something that complements the best parts of a Thanksgiving meal rather than being the best part themselves.
Is that the rolls that are kind of like they get served in like, you know, like a 9-pack with they're all kind of stuck together and they're like yellow for some reason that you don't really understand and and like they're served with a bunch of butter. I don't mind those rolls.
Yeah,
I just want to make sure we know what we're talking about here. Yeah.
They're not stuck together, the ones we've had at least.
Okay, Nate, what's your number four?
I would probably go with I'm really torn here. I think I'd go with cranberry sauce, but this is a vestige of my youth. There's still a few of those floating around. It's got to just be the incredibly crappy canned cranberry sauce with, like, you take it out of the can and you still see the ridges from the can on the side of it as it's put into the bowl. And then also, you know, this is a quick aside here, but when people scoop out from that cranberry sauce and, like, really, like, take away the can shape, like if they like they don't like I realize you're using a spoon, but if you're not at least sort of like taking from both sides so it like continues to be in like the cylindrical shape until the end, you know, if they're just taking like, you know, a quadrant out of it, that always kind of bothered me a little bit.
It's like stepping on snow for the first time, like the first snow. Yeah, that's the first
exactly that's right
of cranberry sauce.
Except no imitations for the canned cranberry sauce.
Yeah, can we just end fancy cranberry sauce? I mean, it begins and ends with the can in the shape of a can.
You know, I wouldn't mind the idea of like a little better tasting cranberry sauce with a little more texture, but the whole berries in there, especially because like it always seems like they don't get the stems off the berries. And there's like you'll get like stems in this fancier cranberry sauce. And not a-
Okay, Tristan, you're number four.
For number four, I mean, to me, this might be a bit of a wild card, but I'm going mashed potatoes.
That is not a wild card. Because mashed potatoes is also my number four Thanksgiving food.
Okay, I thought maybe it would be higher. But to me, mashed potatoes are just a vessel for my number one item, which you can guess what it is.
Which is funny because, by the way, you had mashed potatoes number two the last time we did this.
Did I? Yeah. Wow. I've been, these last few years have been rough for me and mashed potatoes. But
mashed potatoes just outside my top five.
Honorable mention.
Yeah.
Okay, so mashed potatoes, we can all agree, have been going down in the last few years. People are out on mashed potatoes.
There's just not that much going on there.
Yeah, I want the butteriest, fluffiest mashed potatoes possible. If it's basically just regular potatoes, but they happen to be mashed, almost completely inedible at that point.
A quick aside, by the way, my father, who came to great fame the last time we did a food-related podcast, is the man who salted his fast food McDonald's hamburgers. The hungry man, like mashed potato flakes, dehydrated flakes that were then mixed with like milk and butter. Those were a staple of our childhood as well for Phil Duncan.
I don't think we ever did that. We just did probably the, you know, the frozen mashed potatoes that came with the Salisbury steak and that sort of thing.
Salisbury steak, man. We never got subjected to that.
All right. Well, we shouldn't spoil a forthcoming pod. We hope to do one down the road on frozen foods.
Those mashed potatoes have defined what I look for in mashed potatoes, though. Like, frozen mashed potatoes in a little plastic tray has defined what I want in mashed potatoes for the rest of my life.
That sounds horrible.
Okay. Your number four is mashed potatoes?
Yes. I have nothing further to add here, I guess. Nate, your number three?
I would go with stuffing. And, you know, it's got to be there. I have a few stipulations, obviously. Like, there can be some bad stuffing out there.
Yes.
Like, I want it to be crispy to the extent that that's possible. Obviously, having some turkey drippings on it as well is excellent. Getting some sausage in there, especially when it's, like, really well intermingled with the rest of the stuffing. You can't have just, like, these big balls of sausage and then, you know, not good enough sausage distribution. And then too much celery, I think, has been the bane of many a stuffing.
I was going to say, stuffing doesn't reach my top five, but if I see a single piece of celery in that stuffing, I'm not eating it.
I'm with you on this. And even onions, I like onions in some contexts, but I do not want the crunch in my stuffing. I want it to be, unless it's the crunch of the baked, like, top of the stuffing. That's the only crunch I want.
Precisely.
Yeah, but it has to be like one big mealy mess. You don't want to really be able to differentiate exactly what you're eating. So I agree with you about the sausage.
Yeah, yeah. All right, your number three, Tristan.
My number three is kind of the main course. And that's turkey, and specifically dark meat turkey. White meat is fine. It's totally fine turkey. But the dark meat turkey is always the winner.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So turkey is only number three for you, huh?
Yeah. I mean, again, so much of it is just a vessel for my number one item, which kind of pulls the whole meal together. But the turkey, the white meat turkey, can be good. I feel like white meat turkey has a much higher variance, where if you can get a really good piece of white meat turkey, it probably exceeds the best dark meat turkey. But dark meat is always good, solid in every single situation. But that white meat, when it's dry, is no good.
To me, well, first off, you've just explained that white meat turkey, it's the volume shooter of the Thanksgiving meal. It's probably taking a lot of shots. It's probably too many shots because there are more misses than there are hits.
Yeah, I mean, well, so what's your Thanksgiving ritual? Do you guys go to, like, a different place every year? Is it, like, you know, certain aspects of the family will, like, host each year? Because for me, it's, like, Wednesday, my sister does her Friendsgiving. She's, like, unbelievable. She invites, like, you know, 40 people over for Wednesday night because she, like, works in the service industry, and she usually is working on actual Thanksgiving. And then my stepfather, who, like, absolutely kills it then with, like, actual Thanksgiving. So I refuse to go to any Thanksgiving that's not those two, because I know that they're turkey and their number one item, which, God, we're really building the suspense for what this number one item is. No one could possibly guess what it would be. Are impeccable in both cases.
It's always been our aunt and uncle for a long period of time have hosted our family at Thanksgiving. And I don't want to disparage the turkey that our uncle is cooking. It's a good turkey, but it's just, I think, an inherent limitation to the form.
But what is Phil Duncan doing on Thanksgiving?
He's going to be going to my sister's Friendsgiving. And then I think he's doing something with my stepsister on
okay. He's got some mashed potato Thursday. Flakes.
Yeah, no, it's funny, though, like, I mean, because, like, my sister and I are just, like, these massive foodies now. I mean, she's, like, for real, she actually, like, works in the industry. Like, she's, like, a level beyond me on both appreciating food and drink. You know, I'm more of, like, a master of the plebeian foods, as we've discussed on previous podcasts. But, you know, he just, like, he'll go to these things with us, but he just doesn't, like, appreciate it as much. Like, food is just, like, not as important to him, I think, as, you know, it is for some of us, some others of us in the family.
Do you feel like, this is a major aside, but do you feel like that's a generational thing? Because for us, like, the young people in our family, all we care about is eating the best possible food. And it feels like the older generation, the, like, baby boom generation, just wants to eat large quantities for as cheap as possible.
Yeah, maybe. Although, I mean, like, my stepfather is certainly, like, quite the gourmet or the gourmand. I don't know what the difference between a gourmet and a gourmand is. But I think it's fair. They're definitely, for our age and certainly the people that we hang out with, nearly everyone that I know is, like, very interested in discussing food, whereas, you know, it's much more hit or miss in the older generation.
Yeah, it would be weird to me if I had a friend who wasn't that interested in discussing food.
Yeah, because then you'd have to talk to them about basketball, and if they weren't interested in basketball, then you'd have nothing to discuss with them at all.
The conversation would be over at that point. Maybe football, if we're stretching. Yeah. All right, my number three here was sweet potato pie, which somehow did not make my list 4 years ago when we did this. Apparently, I had not eaten sufficient sweet potato pie at this point. But my aside here is that it turns out that the best sweet potato pie is actually now being made by McDonald's. Tristan, I thought you were going to jump in to back me up here because you also have had...
You know, first off, they have pumpkin
pies. Oh, that's pumpkin pies?
That's not sweet potato pie.
Oh.
Yes. Second off, you did not see...
Imagine not being able to tell what an ingredient was at McDonald's.
The distinct flavor balance.
You're going to have to edit that out completely. Just that was never spoken. Me and Nate will never relay that to anybody else.
No, I think I'm leaving it in. I think it's good. The best pies.
I have nothing to add there.
By McDonald's. But no, sweet potato pie over pumpkin pie is a solid favorite there in that matchup. I know I'm alone here.
Okay. No, I don't think you're wrong about that. I think sweet potato pie is kind of like maybe like a hipster pie. I feel like sweet potato pie is one of the coolest pies there are right now.
I usually hate having hipster food takes.
Pumpkin pie is the older generation's pie.
All right, I've already made my derisive opinion known on those foods, so I'll just take it to my number two, I guess. That would be the turkey. I'm more of a white meat person, again, just because the people who cook my white meat turkey do an impeccable job. It's always awesome. To the point where it's even awesome as leftovers as well. I mean, that's one of the bigger reasons that I like it. I think it as like a sandwich, especially like if you take like a little like a French bread, put some turkey on there, and then you just slather it in our as yet unnamed number one Thanksgiving food is outstanding. So turkey, I mean, that probably turkey plus number one, I would say encompasses 75% of my consumption at Thanksgiving.
Interesting.
Wow.
All right, Tristan, you're number two.
For number two, I went with biscuits / rolls, basically the bread that you're making your Thanksgiving sandwich out of. Because the number one way to eat Thanksgiving dinner is to take all of it and put it into a sandwich. Every single item that you have there. Today I had that same thing, except with a burger patty on there too.
And cranberry.
Every single thing you're having at Thanksgiving, and you smash it all together as high as possible, and you make that into a sandwich. And the roll is, you know, it's holding it all together. If you have a soft, fluffy, buttery roll, it can make that the best meal that you're having all year.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is more of like the biscuit to me is the more of the role player in this equation. So that's what, or I'm sorry, the role. Yeah, the role player. Oh, I didn't even put that together until now. So I don't have it rated quite as highly, even though I agree it's an important part of a winning team. My number two.
What is your number two then?
Since I'm the only person to mention these at all, sweet potatoes, and more specifically, a gif of Vernon Davis saying sweet potato candy yams is actually my number two. I mean, I like eating sweet potatoes on their own. My typical fall like side dish will be to just do a baked sweet potato and eat that, since it's pretty simple and pretty tasty. And when you then add marshmallows and brown sugar on top of that, I mean, it's delicious. That could be the dessert. I would be fine with that.
Should we talk about gravy now?
Yeah, let's get to it. We've been waiting this whole time. The consensus, number one.
Yeah, it's my stepfather, he makes like double the amount of gravy just for me. Like I would say that my plate, there's no like, first of all, like whatever plate I'm using has to have like some sort of an edge. We used to have these great like brown plates that had almost like an inch edge on the side, and that edge was all the way like over at the edge. It wasn't like, okay, there's like a middle portion and then there's an edge on that, and then there's this superfluous like edge to the plate that's decorative but doesn't actually like have any room for your food. Now these plates were amazing. We've kind of gone away from that in recent years, but nonetheless, like I have every inch of my plate that isn't covered by a food item is covered with gravy, and I get so much gravy in each bite. I make sure that each bite of turkey is completely soaked in gravy. Each bite of mashed potatoes is, each bite of stuffing often as well, that even so, with that much gravy, it is, there's no gravy left on the plate by the time I have finished that plate. It is my absolute favorite, but the caveat is you got to have great gravy, because bad gravy can just ruin your entire Thanksgiving. And that of course is why I'm so fastidious about where I have my Thanksgiving.
That's true. Justin, do you?
Easily number one. I mean, not even a competitor to gravy on the Thanksgiving meal. I mean, basically, gravy is number one, two, three, four, and five, especially because when you're making the gravy out of the drippings from the turkey, which is how gravy should be made, you have so much turkey in there already. It's like when I'm making gravy from those drippings, I'll pull off a bunch of little pieces from the turkey, the moistest pieces, mix them all around so that if you wanted to, you could scoop some mashed potatoes, do the little hole in the middle with the gravy, and that could even be your turkey. You don't need large pieces of turkey. You can have it floating around in your gravy, and it is excellent.
Like, have you I remember there was one time, this is my previous girl that I dated, this is really probably the beginning of the end of our relationship. Like, we were at her place, they went for like a deep fried turkey. Actually, what they did was they did oh, let's buy the deep fryer, like cook the turkey in it, and then like try to return it afterwards.
Oh my god.
and so like her grandmother didn't really like speak much English, and so she would just like kind of do stuff, and there was just like there was like no way to stop her. You know, like at one point apparently she just like hid like $5,000 in cash like somewhere in the house, and like no one knew where it was, and they just like never found it again. But in any event, we were like all set to like make the turkey gravy out of like, you know, the turkey neck and the gizzard and all that. And then like all of a sudden it disappeared. And then like it came out. We were like, what are we going to do? We have to like make turkey, like make gravy with like no turkey. Like the turkey is in the deep fryer. So like you can't really make it out of the turkey when it's being deep fried. You have to like take out part of the turkey to make the gravy. And then like it came out as like some soup later that like her grandmother had just made, and like no one knew what she was doing, and it was not a holly jolly Thanksgiving that year.
Wow. She ruined Thanksgiving. Oh, man. I'm assuming, Kevin, this is your number one also. Have you confirmed this?
It is my number one also. Yeah, it's the consensus number one for sure. I mean, yeah, gravy is the key reason why Thanksgiving is such a good food holiday, because in no other situation is gravy as prominently featured as on Thanksgiving.
So I was talking with my coworkers about this, our top five Thanksgiving items, and I was like, clearly gravy is number one, but one of them argued that gravy shouldn't even count as an item because you're having all of the other things with gravy. It's not like you eat gravy completely on its own, although you could.
Only decorum prevents us from doing so.
But do we feel like it definitely counts as its own Thanksgiving food item?
Yeah, why not? It's like the defining thing that has it. I mean, like what else? Like, without it, the meal would be nothing.
I mean, I guess you could say, like, mashed potatoes with gravy would be, like, a higher one. But, yeah, I still think you got to count it separately. Because if theoretically it were removed, everything else would fall apart.
This podcast is getting way too pedantic for me. This is just not the sort of thing I'm into. Yeah,
without gravy, there's no potatoes, there's no turkey, there's no pilgrims, there's no Charlie Brown. Thanksgiving does not exist without the gravy.
I mean, is this what this podcast is? It's just you guys like obsessing about the minutiae of food like over and over again and like categorizing things. I mean, it's just like just people gravy. Don't get bored of that. Like, you know, that's just it's just not my thing at all. Like, I don't know why you invite me on this show.
Well, thank you so much for bearing with it. I know this has been a difficult 25 minutes for you, Dave.
It's been a struggle for me, I have to say. I mean, I couldn't even come up with anything to say, honestly. Like, you guys are just like, it's so mundane. God.
Please, don't write the iTunes reviews for people, man. Come on. All right. On that note, thanks so much for taking the time, Nate. Thanks for listening, and a happy Thanksgiving to everyone.